Hi, I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to the Charlotte Talks podcast in just a few seconds. But first, I want to remind you, it's WFAE's membership campaign, and you're listening to the show free from fundraising breaks. Think about all the in-depth, informative, and entertaining conversations you get from Charlotte Talks. And then maybe consider making a financial contribution in return. The amount is up to you, and we have thank you gifts at every donation level. Support us right now and get your own public radio nerd t-shirt, coffee mug, or sticker. More at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000 anytime. Thanks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 55 minutes, officials will cut the ribbon at the UNC Charlotte Link stop, and the first Blue Line train will pull out heading to downtown. Students in Charlotte and around the country stage a walkout in memory of the 17 students and staff who lost their lives in the Parkland, Florida high school shooting and to prod lawmakers to do something about guns. An e-commerce billionaire is the latest to emerge as a possible new owner of the Carolina Panthers, and hip-hopper P. Diddy may be part of the deal. And immigration screening at the Mecklenburg County Jail becomes a flashpoint in the race for sheriff. Our roundtable of reporters has details on those and other stories this hour on the local news roundup. David Borax joins us from WFAE News. Good morning to you.
Hello, Mike.
Kirsten Garris is here, government reporter for Spectrum News Charlotte. Hello, hello.
Morning.
And Katie Peralta is here. She's a business reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Morning.
You can watch us this morning on Facebook Live if radio simply isn't enough. In just an hour, as I said a moment ago, they will cut the ribbon at the University Light Rail Station, and the first train will roll south on with passengers on the Blue Line from the University area all the way to 7th Street and beyond. This is the most expensive public works project in the history of the city. What will it mean for the Link's Blue Line? What will it mean for the city? What will it mean for the University area?
Well, it's massive. I mean, you're connecting one part of the city to another that really isn't quite easy to get to all the time. And so this is a massive, like, public transportation milestone for Charlotte. 11 new stops at 9 extra miles. And literally, I mean, I think it's, we said, what, 25 minutes to ride from UNC Charlotte to Uptown. So not too bad if you don't have a car.
You've already ridden this thing, this leg of the
road. That's right. They've done a couple of rides for media. I did a couple weeks ago. And it was really fun to be able to see the different parts of Charlotte from the train that we've seen under construction for the past few years. I think they started this project in 2013, so 5 years later, here we are.
How's the landscape along the northern stretch different from the landscape on the southern stretch?
It looks a lot like what the southern stretch looked like was opening. There's so many construction projects going on along the way. It's also a lot more industrial than the southern stretch was even at any time. So, there's so much change coming to the North Tryon Corridor now because of this project. New retail, new apartment blocks, all kinds of things happening there, especially around the NoDa area and up in the University area where our studios are.
Well, we know, of course, that because there's a built-in ridership from university students, that there'll be a whole bunch of people riding it back and forth between the university and 7th Street. Will it increase traffic from 7th Street south? Will people be going, in other words, a significant number of people will be going from the university area toward the Pineville area and vice versa?
It opens up that possibility now. On the ride that I went on, they had a rolling focus group of riders, and I talked to folks who lived on either side. One woman lives down in the Scaly Bark area, and she walks and takes a bus and then a shuttle bus. It takes her like 2 hours to get to work up in the university area from down there. I talked to another guy, and this will cut her commute in half, so she'll be able to take from the Scaly Bark station straight up to university. I talked to another guy who lives in NoDa, and he'll be going to places that are south of town. He was more interested in recreation, but you can get to all the mountain bike trails, for example, in other parts of the city now using the light rails.
So we know there'll be tons more people on the 7th Street or the College Street bar scene coming down from the university on weekends, but today is the opening day of the NCAA tournament. Is it going to play a role in the NCAA tournament and bringing people to the games,
I think so. I mean, that's why I think Katz was really pushing. John Lewis made a big point of saying they were excited to open this thing during March Madness. I mean, that's a huge time for the city, but also, I mean, it's a great chance to showcase will this thing work and how much traffic they can handle. So I think we will see more people, at least locals who are living in University or just around Charlotte. I think tourists will probably already be living or not living. Tourists are probably already staying near Uptown, so they might not be using it. But at least locals, I think, are going to take advantage of it because we all know parking is a mess in Uptown in general. And then during a big event, it's definitely hard to park down here. So I think you will see people saying, you know what, let me just hop on the light rail.
So they have new fare boxes because the old ones were worn out. They have a new app, which I downloaded. You can put your credit card in and you can buy a ticket on your phone and show the phone to the conductor who never asks to see any proof that you paid to get on. But they'll be going every 8 minutes in rush hour. I think every 10 minutes outside of rush hour, there's a 20-minute schedule too. But because there is this new Lynx Blue Line as of this morning at 10, they're changing the buses, not only the schedule, but the routing of the buses. Is that going to cause confusion?
They've been doing a lot of education and focus groups to plan for this. They've been using this software that allows them to coordinate things in a way that they couldn't do before. So it makes sense. You know, buses that once went up the North Tryon Corridor, they don't need them anymore if, you can get people onto the light rail.
Okay. So anything to add? Any business development?
Well, I was going to say that there's been a lot of excitement this week in particular with the opening of the light rail. But if you're a resident of, the university area, NoDA, anywhere along that extension, or a business owner, you're saying it's about dang time. I mean, this thing has been delayed. It's been a cramp on businesses, traffic, all sorts of things. So finally.
So moments from now, 48 minutes from now, it will be open.
The countdown.
And if you're listening to us on Saturday morning, it's already open.
You can ride it.
You can ride it right now, as a matter of fact. On Wednesday, students around the nation walked out of class to protest the Parkland, Florida high school shooting and the lack of action by lawmakers on guns. That's what it sounded like at Huff High here in Charlotte. But each school around the city and around the country handled their observance differently. At Independence, they read the names of the Florida victims. So how many schools, how many students were involved in the Charlotte protests?
Several high schools and even a couple of middle schools, but we can safely say probably thousands of Charlotte area students walked out in some way, shape, or form. Some people read the names, had moments of silence. Other schools, I was actually really impressed, had these civic activities. You know, some schools like Huff High School, they met with elected officials to talk about gun safety, to talk about solutions they wanted to see as students. Then they registered students to vote who were 18. And I think that's what's interesting is that you're seeing students say, we're not just walking out because, you know, we want to remember the 17, but it's more than just walking out. We want to see active change, and they want to be a part of that change. So I thought that was really interesting to see, again, voter registration, discussions with elected officials, how do we move this forward? Some of them were writing letters to the students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Others wrote letters to their congressmen and women. So that was really impressive to see students take this to a next level.
The Observer reported that about 1,500 students, more than half the student body at Independence, walked out. Do we know why some students chose not to participate?
You know, we can't. I know I was not at any specific school, so I can't say. But I mean, it was something that student leaders I talked to said it was voluntary. No one was forced to do it. They wanted to. If you wanted to, they wanted to have the option and the outlet to walk out. But it wasn't something like everyone has to walk out at 10 o'clock. It was if you want to join us, you're more than welcome.
I can't imagine being a high school student and turning down the opportunity to get out of class.
Well, I think, Mike, we have to recognize that there may be differences of opinion. And this event was organized by people who I think were very interested in the gun control aspect of this discussion, as well as broader issue of school safety. But in a lot of places and in a lot of homes, the issue of gun control is a non-starter. So right. I think there may have been some students who just didn't want to participate for that reason. I actually went up to Mooresville High School, and I wasn't allowed to go during the actual walkout, but I talked to the students that organized it, talked to the principal afterwards. And in Mooresville, one of the students told me that we couldn't have had an event that was organized around advocating for gun control because our community is too divided over this. They do think that there will be change in the coming years, and they see this as a years-long timeline, but that for the purposes of this event, they labeled it as broadly a unity and school safety in general sort of event. And I think that was true in a lot of places.
Weren't there also some rumors about possible gun violence at Mooresville this week?
Well, I think one of the reasons that they were interested in this, it was actually a week after the Parkland shootings in February. Mooresville High School had some rumors of its own. They turned out to be unfounded, but they got a lot of people on an edge, and they got the kids thinking about whether they're safe in school. And one other interesting aspect of this, at several schools that we went to, it seems that students were concerned that they really haven't been trained properly in the procedures in the event of mass shooting or something like that. A lot of students said they felt uncomfortable.
Well, that's coming, at least to CMS. I know that Clayton Wilcox, the superintendent, has promised more active shooter drills, and they're producing a video for staff and students to watch. CMS overall has been pretty supportive of these walkouts.
These senseless killings have to stop, and if our young people feel that, you know, their voice will lend a quick demise to those kind of things, then I'm all for it.
That's CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox. The only restrictions the system put on protests there was that there be no disturbances and that students not leave campus. I take it that those rules were followed?
Yeah, a lot of students, I mean, talk to their principals, talk to school administrators to work with them to figure out what's the best way to protest, what's the best way to walk out. And again, you saw a lot of students take this not just, let's not walk out just for 17 minutes, let's do something, let's actually learn and grow from this experience. So you saw students do things not just for 17 minutes, some had activities that lasted 45 to an hour. So again, you saw this was an engagement time. And I think that's what Clayton Wilcox says. He said, if this can be a teachable moment, we're fine with it.
There have been a lot of discussions about whether or not this is the beginning of some sort of new awakening of young people politically and what this will mean as these kids turn 18. We'll talk about that when we come back with more of the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with David Borax from WFAE News, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News Charlotte, and Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer. We were talking before we left the scene of the crime here about these school walkouts that took place all over the place, all over the country and all over Charlotte. Nationally, I saw one speaker, I think in front of Capitol Hill, hearkening back to the civil rights, a young woman, hearkening back to the civil rights and Vietnam War protests of the 60s and 70s and comparing this movement, this student movement, to that one. But the protesters of that era, because I lived in that era, were older. They were at least college students. These are high school students for the most part. Is this an awakening of a generation?
I think, you know, I've seen chatter of this all over the place. And, you know, people are saying you dismiss young kids, especially young ones who are not old enough to vote. What are they going to do? All they do is eat Tide Pods and, you know, fiddle around on their iPhones and stuff. But this, what we've seen in the last month is just truly remarkable. I mean, I think about myself at 17, and I could never have imagined something like this. And I think it's coming from a place of genuine desire to affect change in the government, that they see adults not doing their job, and they're begging for someone to do something. And it comes from a place of, you know, just overall enthusiasm for this issue, but also fear. And I can't imagine what it's like to go to school in fear. Mm. And that's not the kind of environment that's conducive.
Fear is a great motivator, isn't it?
It sure is.
I also think here that you can't understate the impression that the students from Parkland, Florida are making on the rest of the nation. I mean, students in our high schools,
they are remarkable.
Our high school students around here are seeing them on TV every night making strong statements about their feelings, about what they think should happen, and I think they're setting an example for the rest of the country, and kids are following along.
Now, some of the people who are emerging on television are journalism students at that school, and I just have been incredibly impressed, not only by their stick-to-itiveness, but they are articulate, they're smart. What they're talking about, whether you agree with it or not, comes from a point of reasoning. Are they the exception to the rule, or is this some ray of hope in an otherwise abysmal world that we live in?
I think high school students have always been this way, but we are seeing them in the national spotlight right now.
Yeah. Some of these students, you mentioned, Katie, that they're not even voting age, but some of them will be. They will turn 18 in this election cycle. And at Huff High here in Charlotte, Rosemary Cohen, the senior at the school, pointed out at their walkout where students could find voter registration forms.
We cannot complain if we do not participate. Call, email, visit your local representatives, and demand change.
So do you think this new reality that young people are demanding change on guns will move the needle for politicians in Washington or in state capitals around the country? Or are these young people in for a bitter dose of reality?
I think probably. Well, if anything, we've already seen that they're starting to, prompt a national conversation about gun control, not eliminating guns. No one's even talking about that. And I think it's crazy that people keep going back to that. But, politicians are starting to look harder at, kind of first steps in this process. And if anything, sure, they're going to be disappointed to learn that Washington is a big sausage-making factory and you don't snap your fingers and affect change overnight. But at the same time, it's baby steps like, the assault rifle, delaying the age of buying assault rifles, things like that, and what are those things called where you change the guns from automatic to
bump stocks?
Bump stocks. Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
But the interesting thing about this, and what I think makes it more difficult for people who are opposed to any change at all, for them to have trouble with these young people, is that in the Vietnam and civil rights era, at least in the Vietnam protests, they were burning down armories and closing down campuses. These people are encouraging you to vote and change things through the system, which it's hard to argue with. It's how it works.
It is. And I think that's why a lot of people are taking these students seriously, because they aren't pushing for radical change. They're pushing for reasonable change. I mean, I actually talked with Rosemary over the weekend about Huff High School's demonstration, and she said, we want everyone to bring their solution. She said, I personally believe in X, but we want to hear Y, Z, all your opinions, because she said, overall, we need change. So I think that's what's interesting, is that you hear these students say, we're not just laser focused into one idea. We want to hear everyone's perspective. And the fact that voting is one of them is pretty impressive. And actually, Commissioner Pat Cotham was at Huff High School. And when I talked with her afterwards, she said she got the sense of she was reminded of her high school years where they couldn't vote at 18. The voting age was actually 21. So she said, she felt very inspired by these students who are, again, making some noise and saying they want change. And I thought that was kind of cool to have someone who is of an older generation kind of seeing this younger one and getting that sense of hope.
But some of these young people want to raise the age of acquiring assault weapons from 18 to 21. If you can vote at 18, if you can enlist in the armed services at 18, it's hard to make the argument, it seems to me, that you should take away their right to have to buy an assault rifle. If you can buy one at 21, why can't you buy one at 18 if you can vote?
I think raising the age on purchase of guns like the AR-15 is raising the age is just a proxy for what many people would like to see, which is to just eliminate those entirely. Why should civilians have these? And I think we are obviously in a place right now where we can't ban those things for, there's too much support for the NRA and for the Second Amendment. But I think, the reason that we're raising the age is it's something we can do. That's one of the things people are talking about. I think it's something that President Trump has supported. Back to your question about will these kids have any effect? The same day as these walkouts, the House passed overwhelmingly a school safety bill. It actually didn't mention guns at all. There was no gun control measures in there. But at least it was something where Congress can say we are responding here, and they're going to give money to school districts to help improve response and that sort of thing.
WFAE's Mark Rumsey reported this week on that side of the debate, at least here in the Charlotte area, with students on both sides of the debate participating in the various walkouts, specifically at Independence High, where some students wanted to raise the age at which you can buy these weapons. More background checks, also medical checks before you could buy a weapon. On the other side, there were students who believe that if you can send someone to war at the age of 18, then they should be able to buy a gun. And others who also advocated the president's position that teachers be armed and be given rigorous, that's his word, firearms training. U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos took a series of questions about that from NBC's Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show this week.
Would there be an armed teacher in every classroom?
I don't think that would be appropriate, and I don't think anybody would agree that that would be.
What about in every grade?
I don't think that would be either. The point is that schools should have this tool if they choose to use the tool. Community should have the tool. State should have the tool. But nobody should be mandated to do it.
Do you think teachers should be able to carry assault weapons, since presumably they may face assault weapons?
I don't think assault weapons in schools carried by any school personnel is the appropriate thing. I think schools have to be protected like every other large gathering place. We protect stadiums, we protect theaters, we protect airports.
Betsy DeVos from the Trump administration, which may be finding itself out there alone on this issue of arming teachers, because law enforcement and lots of people in the schools don't want this to happen. But CMS has, and CMS has expressed strong opposition to the idea. But President Trump also advocates hardening schools. Is that being kicked around? We've already hardened them once, allegedly, here by changing locks and things like that after Sandy Hook. Are they talking about that here at all?
That's one of the things that was in this bill that the House passed, was looking at new security measures, if that's what you're talking about. I mean, some schools already in the past, as you mentioned, have adopted like ID systems and sign-in systems and that sort of thing. We have that at CMS. I think we will see more of that. There's only so far you can go on that before you turn them into prisons.
Yeah, and I know in CMS's statement about not arming teachers, they said they would find other ways through the current budget process of how they can strengthen security. So I think we'll see.
It's difficult to strengthen security when you have so many campuses that are in warm areas of the country that are spread out. It's not just
open
one building.
Campuses.
It's several buildings, and you got to change classes by going to different buildings. It's difficult to do it when you have trailers as classrooms, because you can't harden a trailer. A bullet's going to go right through the side of it, so it's hard to do that. Getting back to the idea, though, of arming teachers, on Charlotte Talks this week, CMPD Lieutenant Steve Huber, who leads the department's active shooter program, said that in his personal opinion, teachers should not be armed.
I want a police officer responding to that sound of gunfire. I don't want the home ec teacher who, you know, decided he wanted to get a gun to protect his kids, but he's not so sure if he can use it. You know, he's never had to consider taking someone's life. I want it to be a police officer, somebody who's prepared their whole life for what they hope never happens, but at the same time, they're prepared for it.
Meanwhile, David, in some rural parts of North Carolina, sheriffs are recruiting armed volunteers for school security. Who are these armed volunteers? What's the criteria being used to choose them?
I did a story this week about efforts in Stanley County, and it turns out in a couple of other counties they're looking at this. It's all allowed under a 2013 law that was passed after the Sandy Hook shootings that allows sheriffs to recruit volunteers to do this. But all the sheriffs are saying that these are going to be people who have had experience with firearms in their jobs in the past. They may be retired military. They may be reserve military, former police officers, those kinds of people. So they've had firearms training, and it's been part of their job in the past. They will get additional training for in the ways of the school resource officer, which is police officers who are in the schools. But these counties see this as a way to get school resource officers in schools that don't have them right now and to beef up their security and others. So the Stanley County superintendent who I talked to this week told me about their program. The school board there has approved a pilot in four schools in rural areas that are just too far away from anything to be able to have a school resource officer.
If it works there, would it not work in a city?
I think it could work anywhere. I think it gets into this area. Do we want more armed people in schools, or do we not, you know?
Yeah, I think that's the question, is just what are people comfortable with? And there's a lot of unknowns with any of these projects, and I think that's why it's hard to find a concrete solution, because there is no one way to improve this. So I think we'll see that's an interesting solution. I know I read your article, and the superintendent said, you know, this is because we can't afford more school resource officers, and they want to keep their schools safe.
So, Governor Cooper has suggested raising the age requirements on assault weapons purchases in North Carolina and expanded background checks. He proposed banning bump stocks. He probably can't do any of that without the support of the Republican-led legislature. Can he? I mean, are there Republicans on board with any of those ideas? Do we know?
Not that we know of so far. I mean, some of these ideas that he mentioned kind of jibe with what we heard from President Trump, actually, over the last month. They're not terribly correct me if I'm wrong, but they don't seem terribly radical. And it sounds like there's been a lot of bipartisan support on both sides. But at the same time, I know that Republicans have formed this committee, you know, school safety committee, read into that what you may. They're not necessarily suggesting that teachers carry firearms, but they're discussing possibilities of how to better protect
and
schools.
And House Speaker Tim Moore is the one that set up that committee to look at school safety in a broad way. He has explicitly said that we don't want to talk about gun control. That's a topic for another time. So I don't think we'll see anything in the North Carolina legislature even close to what happened in Florida, for example.
Okay. Well, another change of topic here. Another buyer has emerged this week for the, a possible buyer has emerged for the Panthers. He's an e-commerce billionaire, Katie, named Michael Rubin. Who is he?
He's actually one of the youngest, he would be one of the youngest owners of an NFL team, except for the owner of the San Francisco 49ers. So Michael Rubin made his fortune in e-commerce. He co-founded Fanatics, which is, it sells NFL and other professional sporting merchandise, and they have a deal with the NFL, which is another huge topic that they might have to renegotiate that deal if this were to go through. But there's been a lot of talk about Rubin possibly needing to partner with someone else if he were to go through with this, because his
enter P. Diddy.
I think there are a lot of names to have come up. And Rubin is an interesting guy. You know, he's from Philadelphia. He's close friends with Meek Mill, the rapper who's in jail. And Rubin has not been vocal about this, but people who know Rubin have said he would be really interested in kind of building up a diverse group of an ownership, which is not something that we see right now. I mean, it's just a bunch of white dudes, quite frankly. And so I think that probably that would have, even if some of the minority owners owned, like, you know, 2% and 5%, that's still like, you know, $100 million.
Well, he's also, this guy Rubin is a minority owner of the NBA's Philadelphia 76ers and the NHL's New Jersey Devils. Would he have to divest himself of those? Because doesn't the league, the NFL, frown on you having any ownership in any other sport?
He's a minority owner of those two. And so it's our understanding that he would be okay moving through with a majority ownership of the Panthers. That's not to, you know, and the NFL kind of, it can enforce the rules however it wants to, right, or not.
It's a club.
It's a boys' club.
So he has a net worth, I'm told, of $3 billion. And even at that level, he could not buy the team outright because you have to have cash reserves. And then the team's going to cost between $2.5 and $3 billion, right?
Well,
maybe two and a half.
Yeah, we haven't seen the true valuation, so it could be, let's say, between 2 and 3. I hate to use the word afford because, you know, he's a billionaire.
Well,
but
stay tuned, because this is months to go before they pick an owner and before. But this is interesting as these people begin to emerge. When we come back, we'll talk about immigration becoming a key in the sheriff's race and the NCAA being in town, among other things. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I'm in our Spirit Square studio with three enemies of the state. David Borax, reporter for WFAE News, Kirsten Garris, government reporter for Spectrum News, Charlotte, and Katie Peralta, business reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Erwin Carmichael, a Democrat, has found himself in the position of having to defend his department's voluntary participation in the federal government's program 287G, which is where they ask you about your status. And if you are not here legally, they'll turn you over to ICE, the Immigration and what's ICE an acronym for?
Immigrations and
Customs Enforcement.
Customs Enforcement. Thank you.
Had a moment there.
Is this becoming a campaign issue for reelection?
It is.
Oh, it absolutely is.
Yeah. It definitely is. I mean, you have not only is Carmichael facing two Democrats, but you have two Democrats who oppose this program. And they oppose them for similar reasons as the community. So I think you're hearing a lot of discussion about, is this program helping build relationships in the immigrant community? And that's where people are coming from with, is this helping or hurting? Carmichael says it helps because you're getting criminals off the street. And he says they're not out, you know, enforcing ICE actions outside of the jail.
Right.
He said their interaction is solely inside the jail.
CMPD chief Kerr Putney has said it lowers the trust in the community of law enforcement because they don't see a distinction, I guess, between police and the sheriff's department. Of course, as you just said, Carmichael disagrees.
The Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office does not participate in ICE community roundups. No one is ever going to encounter this program until arrested and brought into this jail.
Meanwhile, immigrant activist Oliver Marino, who's been on this program several times, and I'm sure you've talked to him as well, Kirsten, was one of about two dozen people who staged a demonstration against 287G at the jail during the sheriff's recent press conference on the topic.
People are being deprived of due process. If somebody is accused of a crime, they are in danger of being deported without having the opportunity to prove their innocence.
So what are other candidates in this sheriff's race saying about this?
Oh, they've been very clear. There's two other Democrats. This will just be a race in the primary. Antoine Ensley is a former police officer, and Gary McFadden is a retired CMPD detective, and both of them have stated very clearly that they oppose 287G. Now, you know, this is a program that the county voluntarily has signed up for.
Right.
They get money in exchange for this. It affects thousands of people every year. I think the statistic was that 1,300 people last year who came into the Mecklenburg County Jail were flagged as illegal immigrants, and about 290 of those were deported. So these are people who are here illegally, and they've gotten caught in the system, and it's coming back to haunt them.
It's interesting you have those figures, because the sheriff says that the program does not target anyone, and that's true. They don't target you. They simply ask everybody who comes into the jail, are you a citizen? Are you documented? Are you here legally? And he says that keeps the community safer. But when he was asked at his press conference by reporters how many people identified as undocumented through this 287G program are charged with felonies and how many are charged with misdemeanors, he said he didn't have those figures. Should he have those figures at his fingertips?
I think so, especially in an election year where this is a very controversial program and it's voluntary. I think that's the big thing that his competitors have been saying, is that we don't need to be in this program. This is voluntary. Mm-hmm. And this is something that the sheriff has decided to re-up every couple of years. So I think, you know, if you are defending this program, you need to have the receipts to kind of say this is why we're doing it, because his competitors are saying this is why you shouldn't do it. And they're stating different cases that haven't been closed. They're stating how they can't get the community to call them when they actually need help because they're scared of all law enforcement. As the chief said, you know, some immigrants don't distinguish sheriff versus police. It's all law enforcement. And if they're actually in trouble, some folks on the other side say it's tough for them to get the help they actually need.
So this may be a wild out there idea, but this is just how my brain works. In Pennsylvania, Connor Lamb is the presumptive winner. It's a very close race for Congress. He says he won. We'll see. He ran as a Democrat, but he's a Democrat who is pro-life and doesn't favor gun control. Here we have a Democratic sheriff taking another stand that goes against what many identify as a Democratic position. Are we seeing a shift in party politics here?
So the Republican Party said regarding Lamb's
He's
stance.
A Democrat in name only. He's a dino.
Exactly. Oh. And so I think maybe we are seeing a shift in, you know, trying to become a little bit more middle of the line. I know that Lamb is like personally pro-life, you know, as a politician, he's pro-choice because
right.
I think a lot of people can probably say that. But, you know, maybe there's an appeal to, you know, the other side a little bit more that might, you know, maybe it's just a political move. Maybe it's coming from a genuine place. But in any event, it seems like something we haven't seen in a really long time. At least, I don't know.
Well, I do think politicians try to read the voters and what do they want.
Exactly.
I'm not too sure about the Pennsylvania race. I think in that case, you know, the candidate is probably the right one for that district, and he did what he needed to do to get elected. There's been some talk that when we get to the next election, there's going to be the district is being redrawn, and then he will have to run again, that he may look different then in order to appeal to a more democratic, more traditional democratic kind of base. But here in Mecklenburg County, you've got a sheriff. He's supposed to be a law and order guy, right? So these are law and order issues. He's been a big supporter of guns. He's in support of this 287G program. But it's happening at a time when there's this counter movement in the city, which is talking about immigrants' rights and you know, trying to bring the city together in a different way. So I think he may be swimming against the tide here in Charlotte.
Let's go back to sports, because the NCAA opening day. Is this opening day for the NCAA?
It is opening. Well, technically started. Yes, I'm ready to go. I'm not
UNC
a biased shirt on. UNC yeah, fan
yeah.
at all.
So UNC's playing Virginia, Creighton, Kansas State, Texas A&M. We lucked out with a couple of really local favorites here in this round of the tournament. What should we expect? I'm going to go to you, Kirsten, because you got the shirt on. What should we expect here, aside from higher prices for everything?
Yes, higher prices for everything. But this is a really good sign because not too long ago, you know, Charlotte lost the chance to host these games because of House Bill 2. So, you know, this is a big deal that the city is seen in the spotlight, that they can host the first and second rounds of this massive tournament. I mean, this is a huge deal, and it hopefully puts Charlotte in the running for other sporting events.
This is a big, big moneymaker, Katie. The last time in 2008, it brought in, what, $7.3 million in direct spending to Charlotte with an $11 million impact overall. Are they expecting that to increase this time?
I cringed when I wrote that because I was like, that was a decade ago. You know, how can we compare decade ago numbers with today? But unfortunately, that's the only year that the city had the comparison with the NCAA 4. So, you know, they've hosted in 2015, I think was the most recent year as well. But yeah, of course. I mean, the hotel vacancies will be an indication of the kind of money that will be spent this weekend, for instance. You know, bars are going to be slammed. If you haven't reserved your spot in Uptown Bar, it's, you know, before 10 a.m. Maybe you should go do that today.
You got to stake out your stool?
I don't know.
Hey, I'm going 2 hours before tip-off, so yes, you do.
You know what? My team didn't make it, so I'm remaining a bystander in this one. But and hotel room rates are skyrocketing. I mean, this is a great thing for Uptown hotels, and we've gotten so many more rooms in the Uptown area and City Center since they last hosted, you know, and because the hotels are so expensive Uptown, people have the choice to stay in the University area. Conveniently, there's the light rail that opens up today. So
here comes a bus full
I'm
of
looking
fans
at tour right buses there. Going by. The parking
exactly.
lot across from Spirit Square Studio here is full of people
they're
playing.
They're
playing cornhole already. It's not even 10 o'clock on Friday.
So
it's going to be a big day.
It's
here.
March Madness. You do your thing.
One thing I had to look up a couple times because I was having so much. The HB2 mess was like such. It feels like a decade ago.
Yeah, but it was only 2016.
They
it was
put a buck in the jar.
Yeah. I think that they'd never actually remove the games from Charlotte. They threatened to. And when it was coming down to the line, they were like, all right, we're going to take North Carolina off the table completely for future games through 2022 if y'all don't fix the HB2 thing. So when they awarded the games to, like, you know, Greensboro and whoever else is hosting through 2022, they were like, oh, Charlotte, yeah, you can still host in 2018. But that was a very real threat. I think everyone kind of assumed that wouldn't be on the table if HB2 is still a thing, which, I mean, I think you can safely assume that now. But it is, you know, a bummer, I guess, that Charlotte is not hosting through 2022. But
here's something else that's still on the table. Toll roads.
Nice transition.
I like that transition. Yeah. You know, light rail, toll roads. I see what you did there.
We need jingles to transition. That's what we need. Toll roads are coming later in the year. The I-77 toll lanes and the Monroe Expressway in Union County. The Monroe Expressway is scheduled to open by November 27th. When are the toll lanes going to open? Do you know?
I talked to the spokeswoman this week. She's still saying they'll do it by the end of the year. Okay. I'm looking at the construction. It seems a little bit incredible that they would be able to do that, but you know, there is also the possibility in the contract that allows them only to open a section at a time. So it's possible we could see toll lanes through the Lake Norman area, which is the most congested area of 77 right now, could open before the others. But right now the official line is that the whole thing will open. And
so we
could see the Monroe Expressway open earlier than November.
We have this controversy surrounding the toll lanes on I-77. Is there anything similar to that going on in Monroe, or do they want this road? This is a different kind of project.
It's a different kind of project. It's it's a new road entirely, so you're not telling people who are driving on a road that they suddenly have to pay tolls to take it. I did a story this week where the two chambers of commerce CEOs talked about it, and of course in the Lake Norman area, the Lake Norman Chamber is opposed to these toll lanes. In Union County, the chamber head there told me that she thinks it's a good thing and that businesses there are excited to get some of the traffic off 74, which is what this road is designed to do, and that some of the businesses along there who lose business right now because it's bumper to bumper all day long are hoping that with a more normal level of traffic that their business will pick up. And then businesses that need to get things from place to place can use that 20-mile road to go around Monroe entirely, and it may be worth the few dollars that it'll cost. It's for passenger cars, it'll be about 15 cents a mile for the whole thing. That's $3, probably a little more for commercial traffic.
And you'll need a transponder, won't you?
You will need a transponder, just as you've seen in other states that have, like,
what
E-Pass.
If you don't have one? They just take a picture of your license?
They take a picture of your license plate and send you a bill, and you pay 35% more.
Ah. Now, how will the toll lanes work? Remind me of that. It's all license
same
plate
way.
Photographs, right?
In the
you
toll lanes in 77 will work the same way. You get a transponder, okay. And it'll work the same way.
All right. It's not a secret that traditional bricks and mortar is falling on hard times around the country because of online sales and retails and the people closing stores. Toys R Us is closing stores. Bilo is now closing stores, although grocery stores face a different kind of problem. But recently, one of Charlotte's biggest malls, Northlake Mall, says it's rethinking a $50 million project to expand. Why, Katie?
And the key word there is rethinking. They have not abandoned those plans. I think that they're just going back to the drawing board and reexamining the type of tenants that they'd like to see in this $50 million renovation. So they basically bought this property adjacent to the mall's entrance a few years ago, and the plan was to fill it with restaurants and traditional retail and other types of tenants that you'd expect at a mall. And now, you know, given where retail is at, they're kind of saying, what in the long term is going to give us the most bang for our buck? And the fact of the matter is, people want stuff that they can't buy on Amazon. You know, you can't buy a movie experience at Amazon Video.
Yes, you can.
You can buy everything on Amazon.
You can buy anything on Amazon. You can buy this show on Amazon.
You can buy this experience. A nice workout. You know, think about stuff like entertainment. Like, I don't want to put words in their mouth. So this is just things that I'm thinking of, like a grocery store or something like a. You know, a salon, things like that. Amazon proof. That's the term I like to use.
Amazon proof. Well, with that, we have to leave because we're out of time. Katie Peralta, business reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News. Charlotte, may your team be happy today.
Thank you.
David Borax, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.